Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
We are back, Freedom of Thought podcast, with Ryan Newman, general counsel to Governor DeSantis, the governor of Florida. So in our prior episode, we talked about the philosophical framework that you developed over the course of your career. And now we are going to transition to the present situation and connect on how we sort of think about the, how we think about the current challenges. So so my opening question here, which I credit to Professor Josh Kleinfeld, who coined this. So some things, you know them when you feel them. You know when you're in love. You know when you're having fun, and you know when you're free. And there is a pervasive feeling of being unfree today. Do you agree with that?
I do in some respects, but then in some respects, maybe not so much. Certainly, if you're wanting to open up a business, it's not a particularly easy thing to do. Now, it's easier in Florida than perhaps anywhere else.
There is that line, the free state of Florida.
Exactly. you might have heard of it. we're very much proud of that. But yeah, I mean, if you want to open up a job, mm-hmm. Open up a business, that might be a pretty difficult thing. If you're an employee at a Fortune 500 company, you might have to watch what you say, because if you say something that could offend someone, you know, you might lose your job. In those respects, yeah, I mean, I think the current state of America is actually quite oppressive. I mean, I dare anyone to go really take on transgender ideology today. It's a very difficult place to be. If you're in the medical profession and you have profound disagreements with the treatment that's being pushed there, or even the concept of transgenderism, you'll be run out on a rail in no time. And so in that respect, what's interesting about that is that's not formal oppression at all.
At least it's conventionally understood.
Yeah, right? In terms of, you know, you'll be taken out and shot, by the state,
right.
or shipped off to the gulag or something,
right.
By the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an oppression nonetheless. If you feel like, in order to, you know, make a living, take care of your family, you've got to be quiet about certain things. Lest you lose your job or be blackballed and ostracized. And so in a way, yeah, I mean, that's significantly oppressive.
Does your definition of oppression or coercion turn on the identity of who is exercising the power, be it government or private actor?
I mean, not necessarily it doesn't. I mean, if you think that your life prospects will be markedly curtailed by holding particular views, perhaps a slightly less tangible oppression than, you know, being prosecuted or something. But it's nevertheless real to people.
We don't allow governments to do that either, though, right? Sort of, if you're sort of civil service, government employee, we don't think that it's okay for government as employer to fire people for their speech.
For their private speech,
right.
Their non-official speech.
Right.
Right. That's right. But, you know, in theory, a private company can.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the state steps in to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is an interesting question about whether or not, you know, states should do that. And I know it's roiling conservative libertarian circles, whether that's an appropriate you know, appropriate for the government to do. I tend to think that depending upon the state of affairs in a country, it could be absolutely appropriate, at least for states to do, which have plenary authority to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I think we forget about that sometimes. I mean, I think we've so fallen into a kind of a libertarian mindset that we forget that at least at the local level, at the state level, state governments have plenary authority in ways that, you know, perhaps the federal government does not.
Health, safety, and morals.
Exactly. Health, safety, and morals. And so, I mean, so state authorities really should be considering, well, the well-being, the flourishing, the happiness mm-hmm. of their people. And if there are ideological forces at work in society, right, that are impeding that, but it requires to address it, it requires the state to intervene until, you know, some global company, you can't fire your employees for, you know, their, you know, First Amendment protected activity, whatever the case may be, then I think that's something that states should do. But I do think it requires judgment, and it really does require a discerning assessment of the lay of the land in a society. But the idea that, oh, categorically, governments should never even consider mm-hmm. Doing such a thing to protect the livelihoods of the great mass of their citizenry mm-hmm. is crazy. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I mean, there's the line that, you know, it's a private company. It can do what it wants. You may have heard that, right? As conservatives, we believe. And, you know, presumably also, like, I'm a private citizen, right? I can sort of have the ideas and sort of thoughts that I want, right? And there's, you know, if the sort of the marketplace of employers and ideas, right? Were the sort of the open, you know, you're at an employee, you know, you're working for somebody who does not respect your off the job freedom of speech, you know, posting on social media, participating in the public discourse, whatever it is, right? You know, you should sort of pack up your things at law firm A and sort of walk down the street to law firm B. But there is an interesting dynamic. I'm curious if this is your sense, where I think some say that the problem is the sort of the alignment on these questions, that sort of the market isn't behaving in a way that, in the way that we would have expected, because rather than the law firm or the private company sort of stepping into a situation to take advantage of the market opportunity, they all sort of fall like dominoes.
That's right. I mean, the typical way of looking at things is, you know, look, if you don't like it where you're working, well, mm-hmm. just go get a job somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the employer should, and then, you know, some way with the employer, you know, pick and choose the employees that you want. Everybody can just go and do their thing. I think one thing that concerns me about that is I think that might be coming less true, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe the labor market isn't quite as fluid as we tend to think that it is. But also, if you're wanting to build a society where people are flourishing, you know, and people don't, I mean, yeah, in theory, yeah, I could quit my job and then go find a job, you know, across the state or maybe even across the country, you know, pick up my family and move, as if that's a practical thing for people, or if that's even a good thing for people. We're becoming an increasingly rootless society. But, you know, sort of a free market approach is, hey, you know, if you get canned because, you know, your employer didn't like what you said, well, you can just go get another job. Now, that job may be in Dallas or, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, clear across the country, whatever the case may be. Yeah, I'm not sure that's good for people. I'm not sure that's good for people, because people need roots. People need to feel secure where they're at. That's where people tend to flourish. So it's just not obvious to me that, yeah, it's as easy as that. Well, you'll just go find another job and still think that your prospects and, you know, your life will be the same. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I also think that, you know, more and more jobs are taken up by concentrated economic interests. I've forgotten what the stats are now, but I actually had seen some stats about, you know, the percentage of jobs held by what percentage of companies, right? And so mm-hmm. like a small percentage of companies, you know, account for a very significantly large number of jobs. So if there is more of a hive mentality among, especially among large firms, right, then there isn't much in the way of alternatives. And, so, you know, a lot of these big corporations too, just to point mm-hmm. out, mm-hmm. I mean, they're all woke, almost right. all of them. So if you're looking for, you know, working for a big corporation that's not, you know, good luck with that. There isn't a free market in that respect. They're all monolithic in their, you know, commitment to diversity and equity and inclusion and some of these woke ideas and liberal social causes.
So the idea of this sort of set of political attitudes and taboos and correct opinions, it seems sort of across the various institutions, right? If we're talking about the law firms and like big business and higher education, and so sort of the capture of all of that, at least the leadership, mm-hmm. right, of all of that. What is there a challenge, a problem of a sort of irreversible capture if the sort of the leadership of institutions control sort of who comes in and who gets to stay and who advances and who gets thrown out? And like, how do you make sense of that for consistent with freedom of thought and conscience?
Well, I think this is a massive problem, and I think it plays right into, you know, our earlier discussion that the extent to which all the significant major culture-influencing positions in society are held by people all sharing the same ideology, that is undoubtedly going to have downstream effects on people who do not subscribe to that ideology. And that's a problem. Now, you could say, well, look, if the ideology is a good thing, mm-hmm. perhaps that's not so bad, right? And, mm-hmm. and at some level, I guess all societies have influencers, you know, people at the top who, you know, kind of set the cultural tone for a society.
Cultures are defined by their boundaries.
That's right. And that's not in and of itself a bad thing, per mm-hmm. se. In fact, at some level, all societies probably need a little bit of that mm-hmm. To give like order and meaning to a society. So, I mean, some of my criticism, you know, is sort of, you know, it sort of presupposes that this white ideology itself is a bad thing.
Is there a challenge of that, right? With sort of is it less common, right, to argue about, to have these disagreements on the substance of what is being advanced as opposed to the sort of the higher, more abstract level of process, right?
Yeah, I think this is a big issue mm-hmm. Because I think conservative libertarians, and I'm back to using the label again, but mm-hmm. I don't think we have a choice. But I do think there's been a tendency on the right of the political spectrum to focus on process and procedure mm-hmm. and to not obsess with substantive views of the world and advancing their own sort of philosophy outside of, you know, this is the system or process that we're trying to preserve. And I do think that has been a shortcoming of the right, because people tend not to vote people tend not to like lay down their lives and really fight for a process. Mm-hmm. They just don't. They do to a certain extent. Obviously, you know, people believe in the Constitution. The Constitution sets up a structure, right? And that structure matters to us. But I'm not sure that, you know, that it's enough to inspire people, right? I think at the end of the day, people do care about the substance of what it is that we're trying to preserve here. Mm-hmm. What kind of society do we want to live in? Not just what kind of political form do we want? And that is the debate, that is the subject of democratic discourse. This is why we have elections. This is why we vote. But that means that once the vote is taken, mm-hmm. and that, you know, political leaders can advance a substantive program, a substantive worldview. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think for too long, folks on the right, though, just want to talk about process and not really defend a set of core beliefs. I think people on the other side are not afraid of that. And I think it's worked to our disadvantage over time. But going back to your earlier question about, you know, well, what happens when, you know, all the leadership elements of society, mm-hmm. big business, academia, the bureaucracy, media and entertainment, law firms, all of the, you know, cultural leaders and influencers subscribe to one ideology, is that a healthy thing or not? Well, certainly not a healthy thing if the ideology is fundamentally flawed, which I think woke stuff mm-hmm. really is. But it can also be a bad thing, even if there's a lot of good to the ideology, to the extent that there's not enough room for people with different perspectives to like raise their hand without getting it chopped off. You know, and being able to voice concerns and be a, you know, and, you know, offer up different perspectives. And I think we are, kind of losing that a little bit. For people who really buck the prevailing ideology today, they are not welcome in elite institutions, at least in meaningful enough numbers to ever succeed in persuading enough people to perhaps abandon the prevailing ideology. So I do think that that's a problem. It's certainly a problem for the rest of the society. And I think there are downstream effects to that.
What do you think sort of supports that kind of consensus? Let's take kind of the general area of your sort of private sector business activity where we might expect to see sort of market forces operating in a different way, mm-hmm. more supportive of freedom and more operating more of a deterrent to engaging, right? Some of these large companies engaging on some of these questions that look sort of, you know, 50-50 questions at best, right? Is there something about how this is developed as a sort of as a matter of scale or concentration or anything that sort of insulates from more accountability?
Well, I do think the capture of corporate America by this ideology has been probably one of the most significant developments, because you really would think that corporations would be a little reluctant to go down the road of embracing, you know, this ideology. And really, at the end of the day, it's a cultural fight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people think, well, or I think have traditionally have thought that, wow, corporations will stay out of that. Well, how can it possibly serve their interest to pick a side in the culture war, mm-hmm. right? Because everybody on both sides of the culture wars buys their products, right? It's like, Michael Jordan said, you know, even Republicans buy by shoes. Mm-hmm. And yet, here we are with these corporations really embracing this ideological perspective and taking a side in the culture war. What explains that? It's hard to know. I mean, I've heard many different theories for it, right? Some of it is just, you know, an asymmetry in the forces of activism. Mm-hmm. You know, the great middle class that doesn't really buy all this stuff. When I say buy this stuff, I'm not talking about products. I'm talking about the right. ideology. They don't buy the ideology. Mm-hmm. But they're also not, you know, picketing,
right.
you know, outside the corporations. But mm-hmm. But activist groups do. They agitate. Mm-hmm. And members of activist groups who are employed by these companies agitate. So they're just a constant thorn in the side of management to begin with. And I think when the forces are arrayed in that way, I think there's just a natural tendency to, so long as the corporation doesn't think that the great middle class will really backlash, that there's a tendency to just kind of go along. Also just think that, you know, because a lot of these CEOs, they're educated in the same universities that breed this ideology to begin with. I think they're just naturally predisposed to it probably anyways, or at least why they may not agree with the ideology in its most virulent form. At least they tend to identify more with the activists perhaps than with, you know, the American middle class. And so I think, you know, it's easy for them to capitulate to the activists. But then when you combine that as well with, and I also feel like I need to point out that I do think the government has played a role mm-hmm. in this as well, especially through the manipulation of the civil rights laws, you know, to push, you know, theories of liability and so forth that were never contemplated when these civil rights laws were first enacted. And so human resources departments, obviously, I think, reacting to that, you know, are incentivized to like embrace this DEI stuff. And so I think that's an aspect of all of this as well. And then, of course, you've got the asset managers who have a lot of sway over corporations. And they've become, you know, now what's interesting about this is that they wield so much power and it's not even their money. I mean, they're just managing other people's money. But through that, they're able to advance, you know, agendas that are, I think, less objective and more personal to the asset managers and their beliefs, what they want, than the interest of their, you know, the people investing in their funds. So I think all of this is combined to create this environment that we're operating in. And while I think the market can function sometimes, I think the backlash to Bud Light mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and its ad campaign, its transgender ad campaign, I think was significant. Of course, Target sometimes gets some pushback on some of the things that it has done. Of course, Disney has been getting pushback as well, that hopefully is having somewhat of a disciplining influence, but I'm not sure that it's enough in the grand scheme of things.
Well, and it's interesting how the capture of different sectors might sort of interfere with that feedback loop. I mean, it's interesting, for example, that I think the Bud Light and Target follow ownership transfer with Twitter, like the ability to participate on a social media platform and sort of express disagreement, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of to have the ideas out there is maybe one element. But then there's also an interesting element, like what you were saying earlier about the difficulty that some employees have in expressing off the job ideas that are sort of outside of the scope of your sort of elite consensus idea, right? It does, I wonder whether that interferes with the kind of feedback loop that you might otherwise expect to see at the sort of reaction to some of this.
I think it has to be. If people are afraid to say anything mm-hmm. or to speak up or to share their own views, mm-hmm. this silent majority effect, you know, they're out there. Mm-hmm. They're just too afraid because, you know, they don't want to lose their job or they don't want to be ostracized or, you know, banished to, you know, from polite society. I think it's real. It's real to, and it's especially real in elite circles, professional circles. And people will definitely keep their head down. And so that's, you know, that is one reason for, you know, hey, if we're creating that kind of environment, that is not a healthy environment. People do not flourish in that kind of environment. And so if that means the state's got to step in and tell these large corporations that, hey, you know, you can't take that into account when you're, hiring or firing someone, you know, that's something worth looking into. Now, I do think I need to make one quick point when we're talking mm-hmm. about business, because mm-hmm. not all businesses are created equal.
That's where I was going.
Yeah. mm-hmm. I do think there is a meaningful difference mm-hmm. between a public corporation and a private corporation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those two things have to be regulated the same way. And I think there's a tendency, at least on our side, to think that they have to be.
3-3 creative is target,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah, and it's just not, I just don't think that's right. And I think we need a lot more thinking on our side about the nature of a company, the nature of a corporation, to what extent does it really have rights?
Of the flesh and blood human.
That make it up, right?
Right.
And yeah, the divide between the people who manage the affairs of the company and the actual owners of the company is, of course, greatest in a public corporation. Not as much so with a private corporation, although it could be, mm-hmm. Depending upon how, you know, it's structured and formed. But generally speaking, a public corporation, there is a massive disconnect between the management of the corporation and the people who actually own it. In fact, the ownership is so diffuse that the idea of ownership is really kind of meaningless in that regard, right? Because the shareholders don't really control a public corporation.
There's some questions that can't even be sent to the shareholders.
No, that's right. And in fact, I want to say I was just seeing some headlines the other day about efforts of some public corporations to, you know, resist disclosing to their shareholders their charitable contributions and donations and what they spend the corporate money on. And now how crazy is that? It's the leadership of the corporation is advocating for, no, actually, we don't really want the shareholders to know how we spend their money, how we spend corporate resources. And to me, that's crazy. But that just goes to show you the massive gulf that exists between the management and the owners. And I think begs for more state intervention and oversight into the management of corporation. And I think underscores why perhaps, you know, large public corporations, perhaps they don't have the same scope of rights, you know, mm-hmm. that a natural person does. And I do think, and I've talked about this, you know, in other venues, but I do think that, you know, that a lot more work needs to be done, and a lot more philosophical work needs to be done on what really are the scope of rights with respect to especially public corporations. I mean, Citizens United, of course, is the case that everybody hangs their hat on, and of course, Disney, and its lawsuit against the governor for First Amendment retaliation, which it lost, incidentally. And so they're taking it up on appeal, but just want to make sure everybody knows that. We won. Their case was dismissed. But you know, they're waving, you know, wrapping them, you know, mm-hmm. Disney's wrapping itself and the First Amendment and the flag and Citizens United and everything. But Citizens United was just a small little closely held company that was formed to engage in political speech, right. You know, and that's worlds apart.
Received contributions from for-profit corporations, but I don't think it was part of the record whether they were publicly traded or...
That's right.
Or yeah.
Worlds apart, though, from, you know, the Disney company
right.
and, you know, global, widely held, publicly traded corporations. Worlds apart.
Right. There's another aspect of this, I mean, because, and I think it's a thread that, it's a strong thread that runs through the sort of conservative legal movement that's framed around liberty. And, you know, earlier you talked about the idea of liberty as having sort of moral, substantive content and scope and limits. But I think there are other newer ideas of liberty, right? Where sort of anything, it's a sort of an atomistic individualism concept of liberty, of asserted rights that were not really contemplated facetiously sort of like, you know, until 5 minutes ago, but you know, like a little bit, maybe a little bit longer than that, but a pretty recent vintage, right? And then you have these sort of assertions of competing rights, right? As against the rights of speech or conscience of sort of whoever is on the other side, right? And I think we see these increasingly mediated through some of the large private institutions. So it's a sort of make private institutions having a lot of say over some highly contentious cultural questions, just sort of outside of the democratic process.
Oh, absolutely. Right, because corporations can't vote, but they're, you know, taking, you know, public positions on things that really is, you know, up to and should be up to, you know, voters through the electoral process. I remember back when, you know, Georgia was considering some election reform legislation, right? And I think that prompted, I think it was the Major League Baseball mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. leave the state of Florida.
Yep.
I mean, Major League Baseball?
Georgia.
Yeah, Georgia.
Yeah. Some of the transgender sports.
What does the electoral process have to do with Major League Baseball's business?
Mm-hmm.
I think American Airlines, you know, also took positions on, you know, election integrity efforts in the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is American Airlines taking a position on electoral reform or election security and integrity?
Mm-hmm.
What does that have to do with American Airlines business? It doesn't have anything to do with it. Same thing with Disney. You know, Disney took a high profile public position gender identity and sexual orientation should be taught in kindergarten through third grade. Why? What does that have to do with Disney's business?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have anything to do with it. And it's just remarkable to me that these companies felt like they needed to take those positions or wanted to take those positions. And it's not as though, you know, a vote of the company was taken. So these are...
Let me ask you a sort of an even more controversial question on that. But like, let's say it's true that there's a legitimate business interest in taking a position on, you know, let's say they've done the math, they've done the surveys, right? And you sort of, yes, you alienate some families with children, which is, you know, kind of a core constituency, but, you know, this is sort of the advantage with your creative employees, right? Like nets out, we did a crunch the numbers, mm-hmm. right? Does it necessarily follow that decision has constitutional significance?
Well, in other settings, I've certainly been willing to accept the possibility that there might be some corporate business interest mm-hmm. that does have constitutional protection. Mm-hmm. But I do confess that how exactly you draw the line, I have not been able to, figure out myself. I mean, that's certainly something that I'm still struggling with myself. But I do think that there are certainly really easy cases mm-hmm. Where, you know, a business's activities are so far outside of the business interests of the company that the idea that it has constitutional protection to engage in those activities makes absolutely no sense. You know, at some level, you know, management is, you know, delegated, you know, responsibility to carry out the affairs of the business on behalf of the mm-hmm. shareholders. And there's got to be some common understanding about, you know, what that means. It certainly can't mean, you know, everything. that suddenly the, you know, the CEO can take positions on, you know, widely controversial, you know, social issues about which, you know, his own shareholders probably don't have a common view. And so I do think there's got to be a limit. I'm just not sure that I've been able to identify, you know, the best line. I mean, the consequences of going the other way and just saying, hey, a public traded corporation just doesn't have mm-hmm. rights at all, mm-hmm. Does create some complications, though, especially insofar as, you know, the corporation is itself a media corporation, you know, or engages in, like, its whole business model is, you know, content and
arguably
speech.
There's a First Amendment hook there.
Maybe.
Textual. But
yeah. But maybe that's, you know, maybe that's the line, mm-hmm. you know? So mm-hmm. yeah, media companies, newspapers, things like that, companies that are formed for the purpose of engaging in speech mm-hmm. activities. Mm-hmm. You get press, but you know, should Michelin? Yeah, right. They make tires. why should Michelin be commenting on anything?
Do you have a thought, just to sort of zoom out a little bit, do you have any thought though on, you know, I think, if you cast our mind back several decades, there were disagreements, but maybe the idea of a focus on process and neutral rules seemed reasonable because there seemed to be a sort of some substantive cultural baseline on sort of what rights count and matter and which do not, so you weren't sort of constantly dealing with these sort of competing claims to freedom. Do you have any thoughts on how to cabin this more atomistic individualism in a functional democracy? Just to ask the easy questions.
No, that's I think any society to be well functioning and healthy has to have a degree of cultural unity. That's not to say, you know, completely monolithic, right? Because like anything, you have to find the golden mean, you know? That's what Aristotle tells us, let's find the golden mean. And I think that's true of society, right? We don't have a society that's so conformist, so monolithic that because that creates its own problems of, you know, tunnel vision and stagnation and so mm-hmm. forth, right? Mm-hmm. A level of diversity does create dynamism and, you know, which is good and can be a healthy thing. But when taken too far, it can be a completely destructive thing. Mm-hmm. And at some level, people need, you know, in order to flourish and you know, live happy lives, needs some lodestar, you know, mm-hmm. needs some mooring. And I think society, a society that has some level of cultural unity provides that for people, some degree of order that gives meaning and purpose, a larger meaning and purpose that they can operate within, and people need that. In fact, I want to say even Tocqueville talks a little bit about this. You know, one of the problems with an egalitarian society where everybody's sort of free to like make their own way is it increases anxiety, because you know there's too many options, too many choices, not enough guidance for people, and they're just adrift at sea, and that can be an anxiety-inducing problem for people. And so it's all about finding the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And I think our country has accomplished that for much of its history, you know, with great amounts of, you know, diversity from all around the world, but at the same time, still a cultural unity and core that binds us all together. I do worry that we're losing that. Mm-hmm. And I do think it creates a problem that you touched on, because a society that's just run entirely by neutral principles can't solve that. And it will just lead to greater discord. I'm definitely worried about it.
So maybe to close on a happy note, what are you reading? What have you read lately that has helped you think about the challenges of the moment, if anything?
So I'm juggling all kinds of things right now, which is slowing me down completing any of them. But I started reading Modern Times by Paul Johnson, which is a great book. I don't know if you've ever read that. I'm also reading The Individualists, which is a kind of a history of libertarian thought, which is very, very interesting. I actually opened up and started not too long ago Family and Civilization, which is a good book as well. What else? I've got many books on my coffee table that I'm trying to balance, but those are the... Oh, and then this one's for fun, Splendid in the Vile. That one's just kind of a fun read about Winston Churchill, you know, in the darkest days of the Battle of Britain. So,
you know
I'm kind of all over the place.
Tracks, you know. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. I have been looking forward to having this conversation for a long time, and I appreciate so much your all of your help and support for the Freedom of Thought Project.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
All right.